This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 130.
I truly believe that it's not power but pressure that corrupts, and then power blinds you to the effect of those actions. In fact, the higher you go, the more pressure you have. The more pressure you have, the less untended your actions. You're going to get short or snippy or not pay attention to certain things, maybe not take as much time to treat your people like human beings. That has a corrosive effect, not just on morale, but also on results. And research shows, which I'm sure you're familiar with, JP, that when employees are treated poorly, they then act out and sabotage their own results just to get back at their boss. What makes this worse is that the higher we go, the more we know, the less we know about the impact our actions are having on other people because of power entering that equation.
How does the combination of pressure and power impact a leader's behavior? What can HR leaders do to help their managers to be better bosses? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. If you've been following the podcast, then you know that last October, I launched a targeted 3-week virtual development experience for next-gen HR leaders called Elevate. Over 100 next-gen HR leaders participated in Elevate and had the opportunity to learn directly from some of the best minds in our field. In fact, one participant said that Elevate is like a master's degree in HR at a fraction of the cost. If you're serious about becoming a more business-focused and strategic HR professional, this is a must-attend event. And the good news is that Elevate is back and will be taking place over 3 weeks starting on Tuesday, May 20th. And over those 3 weeks, you'll have an opportunity to learn from 18 HR thought leaders during 16 interactive sessions with live Q&A. And every session is designed with the goal of helping to take your business acumen, strategic thinking, influence, and coaching capabilities to the next level. In addition, you'll get access to the recorded sessions, allowing you and your team to revisit and reinforce learning even after the program has ended. Who will you get a chance to learn from and interact with at Elevate 2025? How about Dave Ulrich talking about the next agenda for human resources? Executive coach extraordinaire Muriel Wilkins talking about how you break through the beliefs that are holding back your leadership potential? Mark Efron talking about talent philosophy and how do you connect your company's values, talent, and business strategy? Rena Hellstrom, Agile HR expert, talking about how do you do Agile HR and how you get started. Melissa Daimler, author of Reculturing and a Talent Development and Culture Thought Leader, just to name a few. You can register for Elevate now, and through March 20th is super early bird pricing where you can save up to $350. So don't miss out. Go to www.elevate2025.vip/NextGenHR. That's www.elevate2025.vip/NextGenHR, or go to futureofhr.com and you can learn more about the 16 interactive sessions, the 18 thought leaders, and why this is the development experience of the year for a next-gen HR leaders like yourself. And with that, my guest this week is Sabina Nawaz. Sabina is an elite executive coach who has coached leaders from the Fortune 500 C-suite to govern agencies worldwide. After spending 14 years at Microsoft, where she advised Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer while leading executive development for thousands of leaders, Sabina now helps C-suite executives navigate the pressures of leadership. Her insights appear regularly in Harvard Business Review, Wall Street Journal, and Forbes, and she's here to challenge everything we thought we knew about power, pressure, and performance through her new book, You're the Boss, Becoming the Manager You Want to Be and Others Need. What I loved about this conversation with Sabina and her book is how actionable and practical and how her tips really are going to help you be a better boss. And during my conversation with Sabina, we discussed why pressure, not power alone, makes leaders behave poorly and what leaders can do about it. Simple ways to set healthy work limits even when bosses expect too much. Why communication breakdowns happen and practical ways to fix them. How the shut up exercise helps leaders listen more and talk less, leading to better team results. And why the skills that got you promoted might be seen differently once you're in a leadership role, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Sabina. Sabina, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you for having me on your show, JP.
Yeah, we are excited to have you on the podcast, excited to talk about your new book. And what's interesting about your book is that you challenge the traditional notion that power corrupts. And instead, you point that pressure is the real culprit when you get that bad boss that isn't behaving the right way. Can you walk us through this fascinating distinction and what it means for HR leaders who are supporting managers?
I truly believe that it's not power, but pressure that corrupts. And then power blinds you to the effect of those actions. In fact, the higher you go, the more pressure you have. The more pressure you have, the less untended your actions. You're going to get short or snippy or not pay attention to certain things, maybe not take as much time to treat your people like human beings. That has a corrosive effect, not just on morale, but also on results. And research shows, which I'm sure you're familiar with, JP, that when employees are treated poorly, they then act out and sabotage their own results just to get back at their boss. What makes this worse is that the higher we go, the more we know, the less we know about the impact our actions are having on other people because of power entering that equation.
Oh, that's so true, that the higher up you go in an organization, really the less you know about what's really being said about you and the organization, because people are so afraid to tell you something that might upset the boss or not be what they want to hear. But yet, to your point, the pressure is really high on CEOs or business leaders. They have a lot they have to get done, and their time is just very short. I guess that's what you really figured out, is it's not just power corrupt, it's the pressure they're under to deliver results.
Exactly.
Interesting. And then in your book, to get to this, I guess you analyzed over 12,000 pages of 360 review data from Fortune 500 companies. I hope you use AI. That's a lot of data to read on your own. I'm sure you used good analysis there. But what surprised you the most about the patterns you discovered and how managers start to derail their careers from this kind of pressure or power issue?
JP, it's not the data that surprised me. What surprised me the most was the reaction of my clients when they received the information. Here's how a typical conversation goes, and this is true for most of them. I scare the bejesus out of them up front, saying, this is going to be a hard process to go through. In fact, if you're going through a divorce or other major life event, do not do this process right now. There's going to be feedback. You're going to have a tough time over the next couple of weeks. You might feel defensive. You might want to quit, and so on. And then I give them the overall themes in that first meeting. At the end of meeting one, the client will say, you scared me unnecessarily. These are not a surprise to me. I've heard this feedback before. It's helpful. Thank you so much. And I say, wait until you read the verbatim comments, because it is the verbatim comments that are a game changer. If I'm interviewing about a dozen of your coworkers, you will get a report that's about 40 to 50 pages long, because you're going to get all the verbatims. The verbatims have this effect of a gut punch. While there are positive comments, people, of course, over-index on the corrective comments, and they are surprised. So initially, when I did this process, I was surprised at the degree to which people were surprised. And that's what led me to this muting effect of power. You understand hypothetically how things are going to show up when you're in a position of power, and of course, there's going to be a distance. You just have no idea the degree to which power is in the room and ever present.
And so the verbatims were surprising to folks when they finally read that, wait a minute, people don't love my jokes.
Exactly. I am not universally beloved.
Oh, I'm rude at times. I'm demanding. My expectations aren't accurate, et cetera. So people were like, oh, that's interesting. And I think that's the experience I've had when I've coached people and coached leaders is a similar experience of, I'm not surprised by this, which is human nature, I think, to say, dismiss it a little bit like, oh yeah, I've heard this before. This isn't that big of a deal. And I'm not sure I even need to pay attention to this.
Yes.
What do you do in that situation when you start to have that moment where that gut punch starts to sink in for people, Sabina?
At first, it's just holding that with a lot of compassion because it's not just them. It's the position they're in. It's the pressure they're under. Put any of us in those pressure cookers and our monsters can come out. I mean, I've been there. I don't know about you, JP. I'm sure you haven't. But most people under pressure are going to do things that they're not proud of. It's not a binary good boss, bad boss. We're the same person, and some days we'll make good choices and some days we won't. It's first treating that with a lot of compassion. They feel shame. They feel guilt. They feel anger. And just holding that space for them to work through the myriad emotions until they realize, even if I quit in a huff, no matter where I go, this kind of feedback is going to follow me. So here's an opportunity. Why don't I work on it? There are rare exceptions where that doesn't happen. And sometimes we just have to say, good luck. I'll see you in another lifetime.
Well, I think you're making a good point that not only do we put leaders, I think, on a pillar sometimes, and that is very much, I think, more of a US-based industry, you know, we're more individualistic. We're like, oh, leaders are amazing. They do these great things. We talk about founders, et cetera, CEOs. And so we think about them almost being superhuman or doing things that other people normally can't do. But then when we really get into it, the pressure and the power, they may not always be their best selves, to your point. So should we be a little bit more empathetic to leaders and say, wait a minute, maybe it is this pressure they're under. And I'm not talking about maybe like superstar CEOs we're all talking about, but maybe your CHRO or a VP of HR, someone you like and respect, but hasn't really treated you well lately or in this situation. So you're finding that it's really that pressure combined is what's really the biggest issue.
Yes. And I want to be very mindful, especially with an HR audience. This is not excusing bad behavior. This is not letting people off the hook. It is understanding the circumstances that are shaping that behavior so we can take accountability for it and figure out how to address it. How do I address how I show up in the face of crushing pressure, crushing demands?
I think it's a great point. Yeah, we're not, no one's going to say that we think bad behavior is a good idea, right? Every organization has to decide how much bad behavior they accept in their leaders. However, I think your point is helping a leader, maybe as an HR leader, say, look, I know you're under a lot of pressure in these certain situations. What I'm seeing from you is you're showing up this way, most likely because of the pressure. When the pressure is not like this, you don't act this way.
Yes.
And maybe you're starting to now identify, okay, these are the triggers of when I really start to have the pressure or I know it's going to be a tough week because a board meeting is coming up or whatever happens.
Exactly. I mean, in many, many cases after this feedback, the action plan, the work we take on is less about how they can be better at listening or giving feedback. They already know how to do that. And on their best days, they do that. It's just understanding when is Jekyll coming out and when is Hyde coming out and what circumstances lead to each one so we can adopt the tools that head the pressure off. Look, the job is never going to be pressure-free. In fact, there's going to be more and more pressure in the times we live in the elevation you ascend. It's how do you make yourself pressure-proof?
Pressure-proof, I like that. Well, speaking of pressure proof or pressure times when pressure actually happens, you mentioned that being promoted is actually one of the riskiest times in someone's career. Can you explain why you think that and how leaders can make these transitions more successfully?
Let's say you're getting promoted from being a middle manager to an executive. Something that may have been a superpower of yours now gets seen in a less charitable fashion by the many more necks that are craning up looking at you. So for example, and this has happened to my clients, you have been praised for being strategic. Now you go to exec team meetings where the stakes are a lot higher, budget cuts and layoffs and key priorities and so on. And this client who was viewed as strategic wasn't always the first to speak. She would scan the room. She would understand what the temperature is, what's going on, what's good, what's bad, what's concerning, where people are before speaking, which is quite wise. But now on that bigger stage with higher stakes, instead of being considered strategic, she was being considered manipulative. This person's watching where the wind is blowing. They say this thing one time, they say something else another time. They can't be trusted. Pretty soon, people are making up even more nefarious stories about this person who's simply trying to meet the audience where they are and read the room.
It's a really interesting example in that when we get promoted, people's perceptions of us change. But a lot of times we don't change perceptions of ourselves and how we actually add value or how we need to show up. We think what got me here will get me there, or my behavior and my great work has made me successful. Why would I shift and try to be a different person or a different way? Mm-hmm. But you're saying that is a big risk for people to not think about how do they have to be different now that they're promoted.
Exactly. Because your circumstances have completely shifted. So that strategic is seen as manipulative. Calm is seen as disinterested or lacking passion. Detail-oriented, of course, will be seen as micromanaging.
Hey, everyone. After a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Sabina. There has never been a better time to be in HR, and the expectations of HR leaders has never been higher. If you're really serious about becoming a more business-focused and strategic HR leader, then you need to make attending my Next Gen HR Accelerator program part of your 2025 development plan. Next Gen HR Accelerator is the best leadership development program for HR directors and managers because it'll build your business and financial acumen, sharpen your strategic thinking, elevate your executive influence and communication skills, and teach you how to translate business strategy to HR initiatives that deliver value and impact. And it's also a terrific opportunity to grow as a leader, as every Next Gen HR Accelerator participant receives 360 feedback coaching from me and leads with a targeted from-to development plan. Companies who have trusted me to develop their HR leaders include Verizon, McDonald's, Nike, Prudential, Hershey, Kohler, and many more. Our next cohort starts on April 22nd, and registration is now open. Space is limited, and we expect to sell out as we have for the past three cohorts. Go to futureofhr.com to learn more or reach out to me directly. I'd love to hear from you. So don't miss this opportunity to become a more strategic and business-focused HR leader. Another message I took away from the book was that managing yourself comes before managing others. Tell us more about this and what self-management practices you have seen work best for new managers, keeping on that promotion theme.
Many years ago, I was on a plane flight starting in New Jersey, Newark Airport. And shortly after, the plane descended 20,000 feet and that oxygen mask actually dropped down from the cabinet above. At that moment, I realized that and learned this as a fact, that if I had not put on my own mask first before helping other people, it would be a matter of a couple of seconds that I would lose consciousness. Until then, I thought, that's silly. Of course, I'm going to help my child. Now, fortunately, I wasn't traveling with my child. It's no different at work. If you take care of yourself, you are better able to take care of the people who you're responsible for. That's not the only reason to do this. The other reason to do this is to signal that self-care is important. Every manager says, well, most managers, let's put it, say, I want to support your work-life balance. Employee well-being is important to me. How many of them actually mean it? I think many of them, and I've been in those closed-door rooms, reward people who work super hard, who kill it on the weekends. I had this one CEO who had an all-hands, and one of his topics was around work-life balance and how important that was. And then it was followed by a series of awards that he was giving that month. And for every single award winner, the way he praised them was this person has worked super hard. They've been working 80 hours a week. They've been sacrificing their weekends. Wow. So we pay attention to what people do, not what they say. If you invest in your self-care, others are seeing that. A practice that's great for self-care is breaking it down into micro habits. Micro habits have two traits. They're ridiculously small. So small that not doing it will be more work than doing it. And you do it every single day. So for example, if you're trying to get more physically fit, this is not about going to the gym for 30 minutes every day. It's not even about going to the gym. It's doing one push-up every day. When we discuss this, my clients always laugh out loud, and then I know they've hit it at a micro habit level. The reason to start small and stay small for very long is to habituate it and to give yourself the positive reinforcement of that little check mark every single day.
I like the micro habits. And I think going back to the point, though, around the messages we send, the taking care of ourselves. We don't always get those messages because leaders are under pressure. They feel like they've got to get things done. What advice do you have to go back to a leader that maybe isn't giving you the opportunity to manage yourself, or you feel like it's really difficult to manage yourself and you want to take care of yourself more, but doesn't really, isn't supported in that work situation you're in? How do you recommend people handle that or start to have those conversations or set some boundaries around that?
As an employee? When you feel the manager is not giving you that opportunity?
Yes, you've got a manager that says you should take your vacation, but then texts you or emails you on the day of your vacation. Hey, I know you're going on vacation tomorrow, but I need that report by 9 a.m.
Right.
You know, it's the sort of like, don't do as I say, do as I do leaders that, you know, in some ways don't understand the boundary setting. And to your point, maybe the game in that organization is you have to work weekends to get ahead.
Right.
But I think a lot of people now are also saying, I want to have some work-life balance. I'm not
exactly.
Younger generations, like, I'm not sure I'm going to give you my weekend like I used to.
And I
don't
want to
conversation around that.
Yeah. And I don't want to subscribe to the hustle culture. Setting boundaries is super important. And it's super tricky when your manager has a different set of expectations. And you know that your colleague is going to do that. They're going to crush the hard line in their boundaries. So now are you going to lose out to everybody else? One of the things to get clear on are, what are your priorities? How important is it for you? And maybe not everything is important from a boundary perspective, but certain things. Let's say vacations are sacrosanct, but weekends are okay. So make a trade-off cost-benefit analysis of where you want to do that and set those expectations. The other piece is to prepare your manager ahead of time. I'll be leaving in a week. I'm going to be offline. Here are the things I'm going to give to you before I leave. Is there anything else unanticipated that might come along? Here are the people you can go to. Here's what I prepared them with. So things like that. The other mistake that employees make sometimes is sharing too much. It is none of your manager's business what you're going to do on your time off. I've seen managers say, oh, well, today you said you were going to be sitting in the hotel, so I'm going to pile on some work. Whereas tomorrow you're going to be hiking in the mountains. Well, who says they have a right to that time? Just don't overshare. Maybe when you come back, you can tell them what you did on vacation if you really want to. But going in, it's your time.
That's great advice, Sabina. Thanks for kind of going down that rabbit hole a little bit, because I think it happens a lot. And I think people struggle with, how do you have these conversations and take back control? And I agree, sharing too much is just not the right approach with your leaders. These aren't your friends at work. They're people you work with, you respect, but you have to have boundaries at times, especially if someone maybe is abusing those boundaries.
Exactly.
You also talk in the book about communication fault lines, and I thought it was a great concept, but tell us more about what these are and why they matter.
Communication is one of the most common themes of feedback people give about their bosses. It is such an important topic, and there's a number of communication fault lines. The essence of them being that when you have a megaphone, the power megaphone strapped to your mouth, it's bound to create collateral damage, misunderstandings, frustration, a lack of empowerment. Some of the communication fault lines are about uneven feedback, providing mainly corrective feedback and not taking the time to provide quality, positive feedback, or not looking for answers from others and instead being the sage on the stage and providing generalities and lectures to people. Not asking others first before opining. Speaking about your past experience too much, as opposed to what's going on here right now and understanding that. Being unclear. Look, with power comes a two-way microphone and a two-way volume control. We amplify downward and we mute upward. So you don't hear the truth in either direction. And that's why I have this chapter on communication fault lines, to start to make people aware of the many different ways, seven to be particular, ways in which you can create this rift, this fault line that you can fall into if you're not mindful.
Yeah, and as you talk about the fault lines, it's not that these are intentional. Leaders aren't trying to intentionally do it. But going back to what we talk about, having more power and the pressure, and now in a role where you can speak freely and your perspective matters because it's your team, people start to fall into these fault lines, is what you're saying.
Exactly. Most of them are not mindful. They're just intentional. They're just unmindful in a way where, let's say you tell somebody, and this happens a lot, come see me tomorrow. You've just caused them insomnia for the night. Why do they want to see me? What's wrong? What did I say last time? Did I not respond to that message? They mustn't have liked that presentation. Oh my gosh, before you know it, I better start connecting with other people on LinkedIn and shopping around my resume. Whereas it was simply, come and see me because I have an idea and I want you to take on a great project. Or this one happened where the manager told this person, I think you could have more impact. She spent days worrying about maybe she's going to be put on a performance plan. Finally, she had the sense to ask her manager. She said, when you said more impact, did you mean 90% more or 5% more? And his answer was 5% more. You're a star employee. I'm trying to push you further towards greater excellence. And here she spent all this wasted energy angsting about she's going to get pushed out the door.
Yeah, as leaders, our words have a lot of power and can mean a lot. And so I think what I'm hearing you say, and I think obviously people should read the book and take a look at the seven fault lines because it happens a lot, is you've got to be more intentional about your communications and more thoughtful and probably scrub out some really bad habits like pinging someone on Teams saying, hey, come see me tomorrow without telling them why or context. It's really powerful. It's important. You've also talked about being quiet can be very powerful for leaders, so much that you created what you call the shut up exercise for managers, which I thought was funny. But tell us more about the exercise and why it's powerful and why we should maybe shut up more.
If you want to tap into everyone's creativity, if you want to work less hard and reduce some of the pressures on you so that pressure doesn't corrupt you as so much, if you want to make sure that the solution you produce is as comprehensive with as many diverse perspectives as possible, shut up. And what I mean by that is a set of very specific tactics to speak less, to listen more, and to elicit input from others. These are things that are really simple. They don't take extra time and they produce immediate results. Sometimes immediate discomfort followed by results. For example, if you're always talking or doing most of the talking, which we see happen with people in senior positions, and of course, it's very convenient, others will let you do that as well, because then they can just sit back and relax and enjoy the show. If you're someone like that, could you be the third person to speak instead of the first or second? Could you take notes about the ideas that distract you and keep you from listening, and only add those in later if no one else has brought it up? That has the added benefit of having greater impact, because you might say, well, what if someone brings up all those ideas? Great. Your team is succeeding. You're not needed in that meeting, and who wants an extra meeting? But also what could happen is 4 out of those 5 ideas are brought up by other people. Then you add the one idea nobody has thought of. That's going to create a much bigger impact than you rattling off 4 other ideas that everybody else has thought about. I call this verbal overkill. Has a much bigger impact. So there's various ways in which to follow the rules of the shut up exercise so that you can get a much better result at the end.
Yeah, I think it's a powerful exercise and a great reminder to do less, add less value, and really think about, for me, it's always thinking, what value will I add right now to the team? What will help move the conversation forward? And is it really useful? But a lot of leaders who are extrovert and think out loud are so used to, like, to your point, telling their teams, and then they talk for 20 minutes and then they say their team has no ideas. You didn't give the team a chance to have an idea. Be the last person to speak. See what happens.
Yes.
See if you get more time back, or maybe you don't need to be in that meeting, to your point. So it's a great exercise. You've got lots of really good techniques in your book. So I'm kind of going down the list of things I thought were powerful. So you have to bear with me a little bit. A lot of times you talk about in the book that people say, I just don't have time to accomplish my work. I mean, we're all in meetings. We're back to back. You actually recommend a time portfolio exercise to gain a new perspective on this. Tell us more about what this time portfolio exercise is all about.
We say time is our most precious resource. Yet, how many of us mind that mindfully? We might manage our money. We might manage other things, but not always our time. So what if you thought of your 100% of your time at work in a portfolio? That is, you break it into the big chunks where you spend your time. For example, it could be managing my team, which includes staff meetings, performance assessments, one-on-ones, all that kind of stuff. It could be my manager's team. So you're part of that leadership team and you have to do reviews, whatever else your manager needs. It could be emails and messages. It could be speaking at conferences. It could be product reviews. So you get the idea. You have these chunks. And you assess roughly what relative percentage of time are you spending in each of those buckets today. You then create a future aspire to list of what actual percentage do you want to create there. For example, someone might say, I'm spending 35% of my time in emails and messaging. I want that to become 20%. And I want to take all of that 15% from that bucket and put it into my external presence. Great. Big mistake. To try and go from 35 to 20 right away. So have an intermediate column that is about incrementally notching down that 35%. So you might go from 35 to 33, identify one small action, just like micro habits. I'm a huge proponent of minimalism and small things that add up over time. So your small action might be, I'm going to turn off notifications, and between 3 and 3:30 in the afternoon, I will work offline. That slowly, slowly then is going to dial down that notch to 20%. So that's the idea of a time portfolio.
It's powerful. I don't think we do enough looking at our calendars and thinking about how do we manage our calendar better. We sort of let our calendars happen to us. And we have a little more control than we think, because a lot of times people won't even know if we did block out certain periods of our calendar months in advance for just some thinking time every day and just say, yeah, I'm just not available during that time period. People will probably work around it because we leave our calendars open and everyone can see our calendars now. They just fill in that time without even requesting or having agendas half the time. So I think it's just it's a great suggestion to your point of taking some micro habits and starting to look at your time and how do you adjust slowly.
Yes. And I cannot help but add, JP, that calendar gatekeeping is super important. So come up with some things that you need before something hits your calendar, whether you have an admin who's going to do that or whether you're going to do that yourself. For example, what is the goal of this meeting? What do you need from me during this meeting? And what prep materials do I need to review ahead of time? If they do not provide any of those, don't take the meeting or cancel it. Once people realize you're going to be consistent in that practice, first of all, your meetings are much more useful and efficient. And second of all, you'll have fewer meetings.
These are great tips. I mean, I think it's easier to say, it's harder to do sometimes, Sabina,
I think,
because people, they're afraid to push back. They go, oh my gosh, what will happen?
Yes.
But I think to your point, adding some friction to the process before you add the calendar invite and take the meeting is helpful.
Yes.
And it's just, I think to your point, saying, hey, this looks like an important meeting, but what are we trying to accomplish?
Exactly. You said it so nicely. Yes.
Yeah. Are we ready for this meeting? Hey, well, maybe
exactly.
I'd love to get that deliverable in a better place before we meet. Does that make more sense, right?
Push exactly.
It back or something.
Yes. Or I'd like the two of you to figure out more before I come in. You don't have to be a jerk about it. I've even had a client walk out of a meeting, but in the most polite fashion, where he said, looks like the two of you still need to have a discussion. This is the first time you're meeting on this. So it's a little early for me to be here. I'm going to give you this time so you can have this meeting. Once you all have arrived at a conclusion, come back.
Let's shift to talking about advice for HR leaders. I mean, you are an executive coach. You've been an HR executive. You've been a business executive. So you've done a lot, you've done it all. But what advice do you have for HR leaders to have more impact and influence with their business leaders? How do you get that influence and trusted advisor status?
This is such a great time to be in HR. Such a great time. I have seen a huge shift toward using HR as trusted advisor so much more than before because the playbook in business is changing every day. We have rapid changes, whether it's technology, whether it's policy, whether it's politics, whether it's employee engagement, and they cannot do it alone. They need a trusted advisor by their side. So this is, first of all, the best time, I think, to be in HR with very tough, hairy problems to address where there are no precedents, no easy answers. Having said that, one thing not to do to be a trusted advisor is to simply be an order taker. There are so many operational aspects of HR that have to be done. Be careful if you're in that CHRO role, if you have the luxury of someone on your team taking care of those things that is part of the HR ops role, but don't get mired in the minutia. And this is another trap that I talk about in the book. And in fact, ironically, I use the example of a CHRO who was worrying about the centimeter dimensions of COVID screens when that's not their job. So it's easy to get sucked into the minutiae. The second is to speak in plain English. It's easy for us with our expertise to start using a lot of jargon. And the business executives are going, what does that mean? And can you use fewer words to describe that? So speaking in plain English goes a long way. Third of all is the art of asking great questions. Asking questions that hold their feet to the fire and allow them great insights. We may not always know the details of a business. Coming from the outside, I certainly don't know that when I'm working with a CEO. Yet some of those questions I know have hit the mark when it drops them in their track. And they go, oh my gosh, now that you've asked that question, it's so obvious. Why did I not ask that question myself? So that would be another way to earn a seat at the table.
Great advice. Let's look ahead and talk about managers for a minute. You've done a lot of research on this. And thinking about the next 5 years, what are some of the biggest challenges for managers and how can HR help prepare those managers for this uncertain future?
It is certainly an uncertain future. By definition, I guess the future is uncertain, but there are so many disruptions happening on so many fronts that it is extremely uncertain. One of the signals that is getting amplified recently, and I'm sure you've discussed this and read about this as well, JP, is this idea from the younger generations of the great unbossing. Do we really need a manager? And companies laying off and thinning the ranks of managers so that the span of control is bigger. You're responsible for more people, sometimes dozens of people. So I think that's a trend. And from an HR perspective, how do you maintain manager excellence when there are fewer managers and a greater ratio of employees that you have to manage? What are some ways in which AI might help? What are some playbooks and tools? So, because of course, nobody gets trained in management. You get promoted when you're a great individual contributor. I think there's a lot of opportunity, first of all, to get the basics right. But I think a way to flip this also is thinking about a more collaborative approach with the employees. How can we create a few more self-managing teams or teams that come up with their own norms and learn how to hold each other accountable so the manager isn't in this hub and spoke model dealing one-on-one with everybody? I think that's a trend that's coming. The other piece is how we manage, because how people used to be managed before is no longer working. It's not positional. It's a lot less positional. It's a lot more people focused. People feel empowered to post comments and it can neuter you in one post. So how do you navigate and keep your ear to the ground of what's going on. And this is where HR can really help too, because sometimes those things will not reach the CEO's office, but HR with business partners on the ground can collect that intelligence and share that with CEOs.
Thanks, Sabina. Last question for you. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
This was such a great question, and thank you for sharing it ahead of time. My word would be exhilarating, and exhilarating both up and down. It's completely unanticipated, but everything is epic. I think back to just 2020 with COVID and how the forum of CHROs I run, we used to joke and call ourselves chief COVID officers. Well, then COVID came and went, and then there was the next crisis, and so on. And so it's really exhilarating because you're right on the edge every single day, on the edge of your seats, on the edge of technology, and on the edge of your capabilities.
Sabina, thank you. So exhilarating is the future of HR. I don't know. I'm a little nervous about that. It sounds fun, but also it's a lot of work. I think everyone has been exhausted, but exhilarating is an opportunity to make an impact.
And that a lot of work goes right back to the point about self-care. It's not just executives. HR and running HR is one of the toughest jobs in the company. I know this because I grew up with my dad, who was a CHRO for a large corporation, and sometimes even feared for his life. So it is a tough job. And if you don't take care of yourself, you're not going to be supporting your clients well.
It's so important. And Sabina, a great book. You're the Boss. Excited for it. Congratulations on the launch. And thank you for being on the Future of HR podcast.
Thank you so much, JP.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Sabina for sharing her insights on how we can all become the bosses we want to work for. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe or share our podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with the one and only Dave Ulrich. In this candid conversation, Dave opens up and shares insights into his early influences, career path, and importance of giving back and what's next for HR. This conversation will give you new insights into who Dave is, why he has devoted his life to helping our field and HR leaders, and much, much more. Don't miss what is going to be one of the top episodes of 2025. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.